Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is David Yaffe, critic, writer, professor of humanities at Syracuse University, and we're talking about his latest book, Reckless Daughter, A Portrait of Joni Mitchell. David, it's a pleasure to talk to you tonight.
Oh, thank you for having me.
This is one of those books, when I told people I was covering it, everybody was interested in it.
I love to hear that.
Yeah, well, you know, Joni Mitchell is still... And she's been for a while an iconic figure for so many people, and she must have been for you too.
Oh, certainly, since I was 15.
Now, you wrote this book. You write as an attempt to understand the mind that wrote all this music. Were you successful?
I'm sorry. Could you repeat that?
Yeah, sure. You wrote this book as an attempt to understand the mind that wrote all this music.
Mm-hmm.
And did you feel like you were successful in that? Okay.
I'm trying to think of what Joni would say about that.
I know. Don't do that, because you. Well, we should. I should.
I was proud that after all of those years where I was talking a lot about her personal life, I wanted to also talk about the music.
Right.
And I felt that you couldn't really talk about one without the other, because the music is so personal and so intimate and often so uncomfortable in that regard. And I guess what I mean by uncomfortable is that she revealed so much of herself. You know, Kris Kristofferson said to her after he heard Blue, "Joni, save something for yourself."
Right.
And... So in terms of understanding the mind, I feel like I did everything I could to understand the mind that created the music and how the life poured into the music. But I guess the word everything is something that I have to pause about, because it was not my intention in this book to write about everything. You know, it's a portrait. It's not a wall-to-wall catalog. A to Z, soup to nuts. And so I feel like I was able to represent beautiful moments of that mind.
And you first met her.
As well as the soul and the spirit and the body and everything else. That I was able to capture moments of it, to have a portrait, and to have highlights of it. I can't claim to have complete surveillance of you know, from November 7th, 1943 till, you know, when it stops with the aneurysm in 2015. But I feel like I did create a portrait that represented that mind to the extent that she did represent herself, and to the extent that she did talk about it with me and with other people, and the extent that other people who knew her intimately or knew her as musicians, you know, we're able to go there. I guess I could say that.
The reason I feel that you're being so cautious is you've talked with her at end, and she seems like a really interesting, but at the same point, challenging person to talk with. She's a great intellect. And you first met her in 2007, and you ended up, and I love the fact that you wrote this, you got bitched out by Joni Mitchell. Mm. Talk about that.
Well, that was extraordinary. Because here's this woman that I've been listening to on speakers since I was 15. And not just in a casual way, but in a very deep and introspective way. I would lie down in bed in the dark and listen to Joni Mitchell, sometimes by myself, sometimes not. And so I was used to hearing that voice. She bitched me out. This was not being bitched out by a mere mortal. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, I know.
I mean, like, you know, she had some of her songs, especially some of her later songs, in which she had the voice that was similar to the one that I was hearing on the phone, were these rant songs. You know, like, she has a song called Sex Kills, for example, on Turbulent Indigo, which is a rant. The ulcerated ozone and the tumors of the skin, and everybody hates everyone. It's a rant about how terrible the world is. It was written during the Los Angeles riots. And she has another song on that album called Sire of Sorrow, in which she takes on the voice of Job. a lot of bitching and moaning at the voice of Job, and I don't say that dismissively. And I mean, if I was Job, I would be bitching and moaning. Who wouldn't? So suddenly, now, she had really thought through why I was such a terrible disappointment.
Oh, my God.
And why I had betrayed her. I was essentially Judas at this point. And it was so well put together.
Oh, God.
Do you know what I mean?
It I know.
She had really thought through, like, why I was such a jerk. And it was kind of an honor because I felt like I was listening to a Joni Mitchell song. And it was about me. And it was about how horrible I was, you know? And I just, you know, I wish that I'd had better speakers. I wish I'd recorded it. I didn't record it. I recorded other rants by her, by the way. I have, like, iTunes tracks called Joni Phone Rant 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Like. So I have a bunch of them, actually, but...
I mean, that sounds like the challenge, as you write about in the and during those early years when you're first talking to her, you basically didn't say that much. It was what you wrote later that caused you to get pitched out.
It was two words, really. Two words.
Oh, my God.
It was two words. The words were middle class.
Oh, man.
That was it. I mean, I knew she'd never, even when she did get over it, I didn't think she'd ever completely get over it.
Oh, man.
I mean, but you know... And then, you know, we went through a long period of not speaking, and then we started speaking again. And after it ended, at the beginning, I just thought, well, she gave up her daughter.
That's right.
She gave up her daughter. Why is she going to care about me at all? Why would she care about my life at all? She gave up her daughter. And when she came back into my life, it wasn't to be nice. It was because she thought that I would have something to tell her that would be interesting.
Wow.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was because she would get something out of it. And not even something out of having this book, like as if the book, and I actually do think that the book is boosting her sales.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Of her back catalog. I actually think that it is, and it will continue to be, and especially... if it gets adapted into something, which is more than likely, actually. And so, but it's not about that. She doesn't think about things like that. Her business manager thinks about things like that.
That's right.
She doesn't think about things like that, I don't think. So it's not like, she didn't take me back because of that. It was because I was out with a mutual friend. And that mutual friend said, oh, my God, I had the most amazing conversation with David. You have to start talking to him again. And she did.
Wow.
And then I was back in.
The image that I get from your book and through her whole history is one of the great – she's like an artistic temperament in the painter's sense. Mm-hmm. And combined with an incredible intellect. And mm-hmm. many of the men in her life – could not possibly deal with her drive and her mm-hmm. intelligence. Mm-hmm. I mean, and she had all the other stuff going for her. You know, she was the you know, the wraith-like long blonde hair. Mm-hmm. And so that, you know, as, you know, she was all that, I think somebody said about her. But when they finally got to know her, she was a powerful person. I mean, she was a person to reckon with, and most of the men couldn't deal with it.
The one who stayed in longest was Larry Klein.
Yeah, yeah.
Who I talked to at great length and who I found to be so impressive on so many levels. I just thought he was a wonderful person. I thought he had really thought through Joni. I thought he probably understood her as well as anybody I talked to. And I thought that, I mean, he wasn't perfect and he didn't claim to be. He didn't claim to be right about the things that they argued about necessarily. He wasn't trying to defend himself about everything. He acknowledged his mistakes, which were youthful mistakes. And but he was so thoughtful.
Huh.
And he loves her so much. And he'd really thought the whole thing through. And just, I mean, I found myself tearing up at certain points.
Wow.
The devotion that this man continues to have with her. You know, he married this wonderful Brazilian jazz singer, and they have a son, and he's enjoying their life. But he's always going to love Joni too, and it's so complicated. And even when she said terrible things about him, and he was ready to stop speaking to her shortly before the aneurysm, actually. She was cutting people out of her life before that aneurysm, huh. Even people that didn't want anything from her.
How is she doing right now? Like, you end the book.
She's doing a little bit better.
You end the book. She was going out to a concert. She's in a wheelchair.
Yeah, she was going out in a wheelchair. And so she's in and out of the wheelchair. And there are these pictures from her birthday party that were just on the November 7th. That were so encouraging because she looked beautiful in this ball gown. You know, she does this 1940s theme, and everybody was like, the men were in tuxes and the women were in gowns, and she had, you know, her makeup was great, and she looked so happy, and you can see her dancing.
Wow!
And when she's dancing, if you the look on her face is absolute joy, and you can see that she's being propped up by at least one of the men that she's dancing with, and she's really clinging for dear life to this man that she's dancing with. But she's so happy.
Wow.
She's so happy.
Wow.
And her short-term memory is not great, but once you get to be in your 70s, that's shocking.
Right. That's right.
Her short-term memory is not great, but her long-term memory is much better. And I mean, nobody expected her to come back from polio.
Oh, yeah.
She was 10.
Nobody expected her to come back from this. I remember when it was announced. Everybody was absolutely certain that she was going to die.
Oh, my God. I mean, as you can imagine, everybody that I knew sent me an email about it.
Right.
When the news hit. And I woke up in the morning of the 31st, I guess, or April 1st. I mean, I know what happened on the 31st, but I woke, you know, as soon as the news hit, my phone completely lit up. And one of the people that wrote to me was Leonard Cohen.
Oh, my God.
I know. He sent me a link from USA Today. Can you believe that?
Jesus. Let's talk about her and Leonard. That was a fascinating relationship.
Yes, it really is.
How would you describe that relationship?
Well, it's interesting because my way of thinking about it was slightly different from Leonard's way of thinking about it, and some of that might have been just a generational sensibility. Because as he put it, she was a woman that, she was a beautiful woman that he wanted to get close to. And he also hugely admired her as an artist. And, including her superiority to him.
Right.
And, I mean, it took him hours just to tune a guitar. Hours. And then once it was in tune, he would panic because he knew that he would have to tune it again before he had guitar techs. Joni could make all these magical and totally original sounds come out of a dead detuned guitar in a matter of seconds.
She called him a boudoir poet. I love that.
Yeah, that was in a less generous moment.
And there's a great phrase in your book about Joni's music and Cohen's music. You called it barnacled each other like lovers. That's a wonderful term. I loved Thank reading you. That line.
It's true.
Yeah, they're such different artists, yet they really sort of complemented each other in a weird way. But the interesting thing is when they broke up, she tried to remain friends with him, and she just found him cold and aloof.
Yeah, that was one night. But then they saw each other after that night. And the last time that they saw each other, I think, or one of the last times, they probably saw each other in passing after this, but the last time that they spent a lot of time together was maybe 20 years ago. Leonard had become, or was in the process of becoming an ordained Buddhist monk on Mount Baldy.
Right.
You know, which is just east of Los Angeles. And Joni had her own Buddhist master, Trungpa. And these were both very famous, charismatic Buddhist Zen Buddhist masters. And I'd like to add that in the year of sexual harassment that we're living in now,
yeah,
both of these guys probably wouldn't have been able to keep their positions.
Absolutely.
No, and both of them.
Now, when she approached,
but that's just a little side note. But and I'm telling you this because Leonard brings Roshi over, and Joni's so honored because she knew what a great figure this guy was, right? And so at one point, Roshi says to Joni, he asks her if he could stay with her when he's in Los Angeles, and she tells him that would be a great honor. Of course. She's got a whole guest property, right? And so when he stays with her, he jumps into bed with her when she's asleep.
Oh my God.
And he says, "Roshi Lonely, let's go."
Oh my God.
Anyhow.
To which she responded,
She couldn't believe it because she wasn't getting that vibe at all. She thought that he was this sweet 70-year-old Buddhist monk. She had no idea that there was a man-woman
thing going.
I think she probably laughed.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, she wasn't going to file Title IX over Roshi. But anyway, and Trungpa was similar, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
Not with her, but he with a lot of women. Anyway, so... the thing that Joni said to me, which was really remarkable, was that I had this incredible 5-hour conversation with Leonard Cohen. It completely blew my mind. It was one of the most amazing things that ever happened to me. Because everything he said to me, he hadn't said to anybody else. He had never talked about Joni Mitchell with anybody.
Huh.
Either privately or publicly. He hadn't really, I mean, I'm sure he mentioned her, but he didn't talk about her at length the way he did with me. Ever. And so he said, "It's lovely recreating my memories based on your data," because these were things that he hadn't really thought about since 1968.
Oh, wow.
And I read him the lyrics to Rainy Night House, line by line. I said, "Yes, these are all accurate details. This is my biography." You know?
Oh, wow.
But the thing that was the most interesting, and I think perhaps the generational gap, if you will, is that there's a story that after news got around the folk circles that Joni and Leonard hooked up, you know, Joni already had this reputation for being a musical monster. And Noel Harrison, who's the son of Rex Harrison, folk singer, said to Leonard, "How do you like living with Beethoven?" Which I thought was such an astonishing statement. Because that statement implied that being a genius was somehow a masculine thing.
That's right.
Do you know what I mean?
Oh, I know. And that
like and of course this was in a very homophobic time and everything, and
right.
So it was a little bit of a put down. And so I tried to talk to him about it. I said, "Well, that must have been so overwhelming to be in a love affair with someone who is a great, great artist at the same thing that you do. That must have been crazy because it must have let down all of your defenses. Because your music wasn't something that you could hold over somebody in the same way. You were equals." And he said, "There's something very schizophrenic about that enterprise. Like, the sexual attraction was one thing. The admiration of the art was another. For me, that would be in the whole person."
Yeah.
You know? I mean, like, you know, and love affairs that I had with women who I admired creatively and intellectually or so on, that to me was incredible to have that whole experience. And I think that his view of gender was just different from mine, and I think that was a generational thing.
I think it was, too. I think it was
totally
too.
Was. It's interesting how old school he was that way.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is David Yaffe, critic, writer, professor of humanities at Syracuse University. And we're talking about his latest book. It's an amazing book, Reckless Daughter, A Portrait of Joni Mitchell. I want to talk about there's a point, you know, she's living in Laurel Canyon early on and writes the song, of course, Ladies of the Canyon. Mm-hmm. And she's there with Graham Nash. Mm-hmm. And there's just sort of this weird idyllic, like the way you write about it in the book, it's like some kind of hippie fantasy. I mean, it just sounds amazing. It just sounded like an amazing time for both of them.
It was. It was. But it couldn't last.
Yeah, it couldn't. It absolutely couldn't last.
No. And it was interesting because her opinions on things shifted even as I knew her.
Huh.
I mean, her opinions in 2007 shifted to 2015. They shifted. And they always got darker.
I was going to ask you, you got to explain in what way they shifted.
Well, for example, I remember talking to her, because of course she was so tethered. She had this important romance with Graham. She had a brief romance with David Crosby, who produced her first record. Stephen Stills plays bass on Night in the City, and then he plays on Blue. And of course, she and Neil went back the furthest, and she wrote Circle Game in response to Sugar Mountain.
Right.
And especially during those Laurel Canyon years, she was almost like the fifth voice with CSNY. She harmonized with them a lot. It affected her phrasing. And she was glad to get that out of her system, because she doesn't like looking back to when her phrasing was affected by harmonizing with them. In fact, they got together in her house. They first harmonized with each other in her house, which is pretty astonishing.
It is amazing. That story in your book, I'm of that age. I'm old enough to have been alive and kicking and listening to that music then. Reading that section of your book was just it just blows your mind.
Thank you. One night, late at night in a hotel in Calgary, I said, we were talking about CSNY, and I said, you know, I know that of those four guys, Neil is the most primitive musician, but in fact, as an artist, he's on a completely different stratosphere than the rest of those guys, don't you think?
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that's a music critic's opinion.
Yeah, yep.
And she said, well, that's the critical consensus. Okay. You go up to... And then I said, I know that, you know, you really love Graham, but you had to get out of it to do what you did. You couldn't have made Blue and For the Roses and Court and Spark and on and on. And I know Graham sings backup on a couple of tracks on Court and Spark, but as an ex, I mean... Can you imagine? She couldn't have made Hissing of Summer Lawns.
Nope.
And Hejira and Damwon's Reckless Daughter and Mingus being Mrs. Graham Nash. That's impossible. This guy wrote Our House and Teach Your Children and Marrakesh Express. There's no way. There's just no way. I know they had something really beautiful. I understand. But no. No way. Come on.
The sad thing is you're right. I mean, I'm going to say right here.
That's a music critic's opinion.
It is, but it's true.
She said this in 2007. She said, well, I love the man, so I can't say a bad word about him.
That's amazing.
That was 2007. 2015, different story.
Oh.
Because Graham had written a memoir.
Oh, right, 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 right.
And because he had written this memoir, Joni always thinks that she's the one with the better memory, and she's probably right. In fact, I'm sure she's right. And she got so mad about the things that he got wrong, and about the things that he said about her, even though, of course, he said many worshipful things about her, but not only. You know? So, for example, he talked about when he and Joni were together, and by the way, he called her Joan.
Ooh.
Men that were intimate with Joni called her Joan.
Huh.
If a guy calls her Joan, that's what that usually means. Or that he knew her from childhood.
Huh.
She started calling herself Joni in high school. But the men that, you know, like J.D. Souther called her Joan.
Yep.
Et cetera. I mean, if I talked to Glenn Frey, he would have called her Joan.
Huh.
And I don't think it's a great loss that I didn't, by the way, but I'm just saying, like, anyway, so Graham called her Joan. Anyway, so he said, we talked about when he was staying with her parents in Saskatoon, and they had to sleep in separate beds.
Right.
And then he said she wasn't a virgin, not by a long shot.
That's right.
She was no virgin, not by a long shot. And then she said, now, does a man say that about the love of his life? No, he doesn't. And there were other stories. There was a very elaborate story about a sailing story. She goes on a, you know, Crosby's boat, the Mayan.
Oh, right.
And this was shortly after she and Graham had broken up, and they weren't expecting to be on that boat together. And so they were not getting along. But then she just gets angry with Graham for getting all the details wrong about the story. She's still, you know what I mean?
I know.
She just couldn't let it go.
She's got a long...
She was right, and she knew it.
She has a long memory, and she holds...
I mean, and not only that, but she holds on to things. Even when she wants to let go of them, she still holds on to them.
David, we're out of time.
Oh.
We could talk for... We haven't even begun to talk about this book. The amazing thing is there's so much in this book, both about her, and I love what you talk about the music, about the songs, and you bring all of that in there. My guest tonight is David Yaffe, critic, writer, professor of humanities at Syracuse University, and we've been talking about his latest book. Trust me, this is the one musical biography you want to read this year. Reckless Daughter, A Portrait of Joni Mitchell. David, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you so much.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night. It was a Chelsea morning, and the first thing that I saw was the sun too.